March 19th, 2009.
Microwave.
First item on the agenda today is House Bill, public hearing on House Bill 2789.
House Bill 2789 clarifies the definition of parole and probation officers. The amendment provides that retired parole and probation officers are exempt from being prosecuted for unlawful possession of a firearm. We do not yet have the fiscal impact statement on this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Lash, yeah, I might bring all four of you on. Yeah.
Let me go ahead and, for the purposes of time, get started. For the record, Brian DeLashman, I'm here representing the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers and the Oregon Council of Police Associations. With that, the issue today in front of you, the parole and probation officers will go into a little more detail, but let me start by saying that the world that we live in now as far as public safety is not the old Ozzie and Harriet or Leave It to Beaver land anymore. The types of situations that parole and probation officers and all public safety officers are seeing now are far more intense, far more dangerous as far as home visits and so forth. And this bill, we believe, doesn't do anything in its original form other than clarify what we believe to be the existing statute as to whether or not a parole and probation officer can carry a firearm, whether they have to, in fact, have been fully certified and be on the job for a year or more, or whether or not they just simply need to be able to be on the job and have completed DPFST firearms training. There is a one-word change. You'll find it on page 2, on line 26. We believe that the way the statute was originally constructed is clear. There is evidently at least one county council that believes that it wasn't clear. And so we're just adding that word to make it totally clear that those two are not inclusive, but in fact can be the one or the other. With that, let me also give you one additional heads up. You have an amendment, a dash one amendment, before these people speak that I wanted to address. This is another issue related to, obviously, parole and probation officers and retired parole and probation officers that we believe was going to be introduced as a bill, and there was some mix-up as a separate bill. I believe it was requested, and for whatever reason, either LC lost it. So because it's a related issue, we decided, and it was something that we were going to support and put forward, and it's related, we decided that we would offer an amendment in this particular section. That's the amendment, the dash one amendments to 2789. And if you're familiar with these sections of statute, currently the statute 166, 250 is unlawful possession of a firearm. The section that we're amending, 166-260, is the exceptions to that particular statute. And what we're suggesting on this amendment, and the amendment is actually just line 5, is the way it currently reads is sheriffs, constables, marshals, police officers, whether active or honorably retired, parole and probation officers, or other duly appointed peace officers. We're moving the parole and probation officers farther up in that sentence, so it would read sheriffs, constables, marshals, parole and probation officers, police officers, whether active or inactive. The net effect of that is that a parole and probation officer who is retired could, in fact, still have the exemption under that particular section. Obviously, you will hear from these folks about the reason for that, but given the fact that they work with some pretty intense situations over their life and their career, they do, in fact, have, in some occasions, the opportunity to run into some people that may have a grudge to settle with them, and we believe this just add some additional protection, personal protection for them. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jess.
Thank you, Chairman Barker and members of the committee. I'm Jess Anders, a parole and probation officer in Deschutes County. Currently, when I was hired and when we hire other parole and probation officers, we are given our badge and our handcuffs and a caseload of adult offenders that are on supervised parole or probation, who consist of anywhere from people who have been homicide or assault or carrying dangerous weapons, and we're told to go out into the field and visit them in their homes, etc., and to see if they are in compliance with the terms of their supervision. However, the way the law currently reads, we're not able to be issued our firearm that is a department issued firearm until after we are employed for 1 year or more. And this has created a extremely a big officer safety issue with us. It is a of extreme importance that we modify the language within the law to allow us to carry our firearm when we are hired, like a police officer. When they are hired, they are given their a badge, their handcuffs, and a firearm on day one, and they don't have to wait a year before they are issued their firearm. And it's pretty important to us, and that this law is modified to allow us to carry our firearm within the first year of hire. And that is pretty much the nuts and bolts of the problem that we have. Our management, our county executives in our county agree that we should be able to carry our firearm within the first year. However, the law says that they can't, or at least the way they are interpreting the law, the way it is currently read and understood, that they are unable to provide us with this important officer safety tool. And it's just really unsafe out there to be arresting people who are, in fact, oftentimes carrying a firearm when we are not able to carry a firearm to help prevent us from attack involving deadly force. Thank you very much.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Deputy William Broughton. I work for the Marion County Sheriff's Office Parole and Probation Unit. I'm here today and testify on behalf of 2789 with regards to not only arming the parole and probation officers within the first year of employment, but also the amendment to allow retired officers to continue to carry throughout the rest of their retired life with regards to the public safety issues and personal safety issues, both with the officer and their family. My testimony was somewhat lengthy, and then I was informed that the time constraints may be imposed, so I'm going to summarize it the best that I can. I started in Marion County in 1994 with the Marion County Department of Community Corrections. We were unarmed. I had an example in my testimony of a time that myself, my wife, and my child were confronted in the community by offenders that I had supervised while working in custody at the jail. Thankfully, I had been taught by a training officer that it was important to establish safety protocols with your family when you live and reside in the same community with which you work, and I was able to have my family leave the incident, remain at the incident, and retreat from the incident myself without any further confrontation with the individuals. And I feel since the arming of the Marion County Sheriff's Office with the appointment of Raul Ramirez in 1998 that the perception of the offenders that we come across with on a daily basis has changed. They recognize now that every officer is a sworn deputy and could be armed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I thankfully have never had another incident outside of the workplace with any offenders in the community. The second part of my testimony is with regards to my transfer to parole and probation last year in 2008. I just recently submitted my certification. I just finished my trainee status as a 9-month employee with the Department of Parole and Probation. As Jess stated, during your training, you are obligated to satisfactorily complete field work with an FTO, and that sometimes puts you in a position of harm to your personal safety. An example, again, that I stated in this case was I was in a residence with my FTO. There was a dog present. The dog was released inadvertently by a small child in the residence, and the dog charged me. Thankfully, I was armed. My FTO was not in the close proximity enough to defend me had the situation arisen. I did draw my firearm, and thankfully, again, the owner of the animal was able to contain the animal before I had to use that force against the animal. Had the animal attacked me, I would have been defenseless had I not had a firearm with me. And a second incident was we went into a residence that turned out being a meth house. We went there for a standard home visit. My task was to make contact with the resident owner, who was also on supervision, and perform the duties of a parole and probation officer in the field. Lo and behold, four individuals in the house tried to flee the house, and I was asked to cover a Salem police officer and help protect his personal safety with my firearm because we were outnumbered 2-6. Had I not had that firearm and had they been armed, that Salem officer could have lost his life, I could have lost my life. So I feel very strongly about being armed in the field, and I don't think anyone should be presented with the task of having to go out into the community unarmed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chairman Barker and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Sattel. I'm a parole and probation officer with Yamhill County, and I've been a PO with Yamhill County for 20 years now. My testimony was also a little longer, and I will keep that as short as possible. I come from this a little different perspective than both Jess and Bill in that I have spent the majority of my career actually unarmed. It's only been in the last 2 years of my 20 years that I have carried a firearm. The reason behind that is, as you well know, the law allows for the arming of parole and probation officers, but only at the county's discretion. If the county chooses not to offer arming to their POs, it's not an option to those POs. And it was only back in the legislative session back in 2003, I had the opportunity to testify also on FOPO, the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers' behalf, to move POs back into strike bar status. When we succeeded with that, my department, the POs in Yamhill County, were able to take the issue of arming to arbitration. We did so. We came out successful, and so it's only been in the last couple of years that POs in our county have been able to be armed. With that, I'll tell you, it has changed it's changed a bit of my outlook, and I can't imagine doing my job today without having the option of being armed. Have I pulled my firearm on a regular basis? No, I have not. I've pulled it twice, though, in those 2 years, and that in both circumstances, that was to provide lethal force to my partner who had pulled his taser, and so I was providing lethal cover in the case of things going bad in both of those situations. I would just note in here, as Jess mentioned, police officers are given the option from the time that they have completed their firearms training to carry their firearms. We don't ask them to go out and patrol the streets without a firearm. But we have parole and probation officers who every day our only job is to deal with convicted felons all day long. And every home we go into is that of a convicted felon. And to ask a PO to go into those homes without that option is scary, quite frankly. I think the three of us can sit here and tell you some war stories, and I can tell you 20 years worth of war stories. We find clients hiding under piles of dirty laundry in a closet. All of a sudden you notice the laundry's moving and you find people hiding under there. We don't know when we can't see someone, when we can't see their hands, or when they refuse to follow our directives. We have to make split-second decisions. And in doing those home visits, we don't necessarily go to a home visit with the idea we're going to arrest the client that's there. We go because we're required to do home visits, and oftentimes we find violations, and in split second, we have to make a decision to take that person into custody. And then if they don't follow our directives, again, we're making further split second decisions. And so we're asking that you support this change in the wording, a small change, that it would allow for the POs to have that option in those counties that are concerned that maybe the law doesn't read it quite the way they think it should. We're asking for this small change in the law so that the POs out in the community doing the home visits can remain as safe as possible. Thank you.
Representative Stigler.
Yeah, first I want to apologize to the committee that it's my county that has caused this. It's their interpretation. No, and I wanted to welcome Mr. Anders. I've known him for a long time and know that he doesn't come here lightly on this issue, that it's something that is of great importance to these folks out here in the field, who I think we oftentimes don't look at as necessarily law enforcement, but that's exactly what they do. So thank you all for coming forward today.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, if I recall correctly, certain counties have their POs carry firearms and certain counties don't. And could you refresh my memory on what Multnomah County's policy is?
Chairman Barker, Representative Shields, Multnomah's policy is they do allow for optional arming in Multnomah County, yes.
Okay.
There's actually, when Yamhill County went to arbitration on this issue, there were five counties that didn't allow for at least optional arming. With Yamhill County winning our arbitration, that's left four. I believe to date there are still four counties that say absolutely no to arming.
Okay. Fellow? So 2 points. One, this won't affect a county's ability to make that decision. And two, can you paint a picture for me of why this is needed for the retired POs in the amendment, or are we plan on going forward with the amendment? Could you paint me that picture?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, the answer to your question is yes. It doesn't change anything as far as those counties that want to have the option. The situation that Lisa has talked about is that in her county, they did go to arbitration because they were able to show the danger, the safety factor, those officers. So they would have to go through a process in order to compel the county if the county chose not to have those people at least have the optional piece. The second piece, as far as the retired officers or retired parole and probation officers, is because of the types of individuals that they work with on a daily basis, the same way as Bill talked about when he was a corrections officer, they run into people in the community many times who have a grudge with them. And that grudge does not end when they retire. And currently, that's why a retired police officer has the ability to be able to carry, because they may run into a situation in which somebody has a grudge and comes after them. In this case, they're just asking for that same protection, the same opportunity for protection that retired constables, sheriffs, marshals, and other police officers have of in retirement being able to carry.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
I'm not real familiar with gun law, although you would think I would be by now. But the what would prohibit somebody who's retired from simply getting a concealed weapon permit like anybody else?
Nothing. The answer is nothing, except for, I guess, going through the process and so forth.
You have to go through training, I think, every couple of years, and you have to pay by the permit and so on.
And so, Mr. Chair, if I could, so this would basically say to them that they don't need to do that because of their kind of past service, and that if they got, say, they got pulled over and they had a firearm on them, that they wouldn't be subject to
162.50. Yeah.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure I understood all that.
Thank you. Representative Stigler again, please.
Mr. Lashma, just on the point that you were making to Mr. Shields, or Representative Shields' question regarding the sort of the grudge, and any of you folks can answer this. I mean, it's been my experience that probably most defendants tend to carry less of a grudge with respect to a police officer who they see as doing their job as versus a parole or probation officer who they see as a consistent and constant.
In your face.
Yeah. Anybody care to comment?
Yes. In fact, I taught at the Police Academy Officer Safety for about 10 years, and I Our job is not only going out into the field and supervising these people on supervision, but we testify in court, and we are asked by the judge on a weekly basis what our recommendation is if this person who was on probation should be have their probation revoked and sentenced to the state penitentiary. And oftentimes our answer is yes, that we are recommending that this individual's probation be revoked and they be sentenced to the state penitentiary. I don't have it with me here, but there has been at least two probation officers killed after they left work by an inmate who was sentenced to the state penitentiary based upon the recommendation of their probation officer. And that's not in Oregon. It is a United States statistic. But that is the reason why when we are retired, we will need to have the option to carry our firearm in retirement as well, is to prevent us from being killed by offenders who we have recommended to the judge that they be sentenced to the state penitentiary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, since I came in late on this, and you might have already answered these questions, but how many counties right now do not allow parole and probation officers being armed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, we did answer that question.
You did, okay.
And there's currently four that we're aware of. It was five until Yamhill County, and Lisa answered that question, but there's four. This would not compel them unless there is an arbitration about the safety of the officers and what they do, and that's what happened in Yamhill County.
Mr. Chair,
I think I'm fine with this, just so you know, my questions aren't indicating a lack of support, but I do want to make sure I understand what I'm voting for. The Dash 1 amendment, I'm looking at it, and it says honorably retired. I assume that if somebody retires as a PO and then a couple of years for some reason, you know, runs afoul of the law or something that would preclude them from us wanting them to have a right to have a firearm under all instances, that that could be revoked somehow. Is that what honorably retired means?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, that's the existing language as it covers police officers and everyone else. So I assume that they have a system. If somebody, including a police officer, were subsequently charged with a felony, they wouldn't have the ability to carry a firearm anyway. So I think honorably retired is
okay.
The existing statute, and we're just moving the piece forward.
And it doesn't get, I mean, it's still, you don't get on an airplane with it, and all those things are still, it's essentially like a, pretty much like the CHL.
Okay.
But you don't have to get you're covered by state law. And Mr. Lash, I'd just like to add one other thing, too, that I know you all know, that it isn't only your client, but it's also the family and friends that can present a great danger, especially you who live in the same neighborhood of the people you're supervising.
And, Mr. Chair, that was the point that Bill Roten was talking about, was his family was approached. And thank God he did have an exit strategy.
I mean the family of the
Oh,
client.
The family of the
you have more than just
yes.
The one guy who's mad
exactly.
At you. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Any further discussion? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Representative Wisnant.
I move the dash ones into 2789, House Bill 2789.
Representative Wisnant moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2789. Is there any discussion?
We open a work session.
We open a work session?
Oh. Yeah. Work session is open. Representative Wisnant has moved the dash ones into House Bill 2789. Is there any discussion, any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We don't have the fiscal back, so we will not be able to work the bill today. I'm closing the work session and the public hearing. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2857. If you want to explain the
yeah.
Thank you.
2857 and House Bill 2872 are essentially the same bill, so we're proceeding right now in 2857. Some clarification on the background statement you have. So just give me a moment. House Bill 2857 initially increased the punishment for second and subsequent convictions for unlawful possession of a firearm. You have in front of you a Dash 1 amendment. The intention of the Dash 1 amendment was to leave unlawful possession of a firearm as a misdemeanor and instead to make felon in possession of a firearm a level 3 on the sentencing guideline rather than a level 6, which is where it currently stands, except in the situation where an offender has a previous conviction for a person felony. In that instance, it would be a level 8.
And the reason for that is they're moving it.
Okay. The difference is for the fiscal impact. I will tell you that the Dash 1 you have in front of you has the language I just explained regarding the felon in possession statute. However, that amendment and another draft that we have of it both leave intact the initial 2857 and 2872. So, just to clarify, the amendment that you'll ultimately be proceeding on but is not in front of you today leaves unlawful possession of a firearm the same as it currently stands as a misdemeanor and will address only the felon in possession gridlock.
Sean Rydell, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Sean Riddell. I'm a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County and have been since August of 2002. Spent 2 years prosecuting property crime offenses, and for the last approximately 4 years, I have been prosecuting gang and gun-related crimes. I'm here speaking specifically on the amendment that Council Seville mentioned earlier as it relates to felon in possession of a firearm. I had some handouts regarding the sentencing guideline grid, if you had that in front of you, to give you the appropriate orientation. Felon in possession of a firearm is currently a level 6 crime. This amendment would make that crime a level 3 crime, except in the case where the offender has a prior violent person crime. Then it would be a level 8 crime. The question is, why make the change? First, let's address the issues with property offenders. It's been my experience, both in property offenses and working violent gang and gun-related crimes, that property offenders who do not have a violent history are not likely to commit a violent crime. A firearm in their possession doesn't pose the threat to public danger that a firearm in the possession of a violent criminal possesses. Furthermore, it's been my experience over the last 4 years of when I run into someone who has only a property crime history that that firearm is really held through ignorance, accident, or happenstance. It's a firearm, a family heirloom that they didn't get rid of. They like to hunt and refuse to give up the ability to hunt, or they just happen to have it in their home and holding it in possession for a family member or friend. Those are not the kind of conduct that we want to send someone to prison for, incarcerate them even for 13 to 14 months, or need to be on supervision for 3 years. On the other hand, violent criminals. In my experience in gang crimes and prosecuting violent offenses, and allow me to clarify, gang crimes include domestic violence crimes, crimes involving delivery of a controlled substance, violent sex crimes, drive-by shootings, and homicides. I cover the gamut of gang crimes. Gamut of violent crimes as long as it's gang-related. And what I've determined is that there's a very small segment of the population that is capable and willing of committing a violent crime. And in the gang world, that individual very often has 3 or 4 people following them. 3 or 4 people that would not, or probably would never, commit a violent crime but for the existence of that one personality, that one violent personality. We've made significant success in the Multnomah County area by finding out who that person is and eliminating them, placing them on strict supervision, or incarcerating them. And then the other 3 or 4 members they rag along with them, they might fly the colors of a gang member, but they don't commit violent acts. And this amendment will give us a stronger ability to, one, hang over more time over their head or incarcerate that particular violent individual for more time. Also, I think it better addresses the resources of the state in attacking violent criminals than it does in those who are nonviolent. And finally, it's my experience that the causes of property crime offenses is much different than the causes of violent crimes. And the way you combat property crimes is not so much through incarceration as you would with violent crimes, but more through education, rehabilitation, and employment. And I think the current status of a level six fails to recognize the difference between property crimes and violent crimes.
Questions? Representative Olson?
Yeah, I appreciate your testimony on this and the direction where you're going with this. Do you see this as a wash, going to a level three up to a level eight?
Can you define wash for me?
Well,
I'm sorry, Representative Barker.
Better question would be, what's the percentage of your property crime offenders versus that of your violent crime offenders?
I didn't have any opportunity to pull up those stats. We have a database system. Representative Barker, I apologize.
That's right.
Representative Olson. I didn't have the opportunity to pull that out of our database. I can give you an educated guess from my experience. What I find in my felon in possession of firearms, the standalone count, right now I have indictments with felon in possession of a firearm where there might be a robbery count with it or an unlawful use count with it. My standalone felon in possession of a firearm counts, the majority of them are property offenders. Rarely do I find a violent offender with a felon in possession of a firearm who hadn't used it or threatened to use it.
Thank you.
Further questions? And is the impetus for this coming up out of the, it's probably been around for a while, but it was kind of kicked into high gear, the request for this bill, after all the shootings in Portland recently?
Representative Barker, I am not going to say that the recent shootings the recent shootings in the Portland area wasn't an impetus for me coming down here to do this. But this is an idea I've been toying with quite some time. And I prepared a memo for my office discussing whether we should be treating property offenders as felon in possession of a firearm the same way we're treating violent offenders, in the hopes of some sort of internal policy to fast-track those crimes. Because I really see that as a drain of resources, an unnecessary drain of resources, when you have a nonviolent offender with a firearm.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we will be looking forward to getting to the correct amendment on that later on. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2857. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2796.
House Bill 2796 prohibits setting aside a conviction or arrest for criminally negligent homicide. It does not yet have a fiscal or revenue impact statement.
Ann Pratt, Janet Lovelace, and Doug Harkle Road, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name's Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Crime Victims United, Parents of Murdered Children, and the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. House Bill 2796 is very personal for me, but I would like to say, first of all, that the portion that I'm interested in is prohibiting the setting aside of the convictions of criminally negligent homicides. I'm here today to testify as the mother of a victim of a very violent homicide. We received the call that's every parent's worst nightmare in the middle of the night in September of 1998. My youngest son had been killed by a drunk driver. The man who killed my son was charged with manslaughter one, but the conviction was dropped clear down to criminally negligent homicide by the judge, and he received only 18 months. I've been working with Chair Barker on House Bill 2796 after I realized that criminally negligent homicide convictions were routinely being expunged or set aside in our courtrooms, a procedure that I find outrageous. My first reaction was, does it mean that I get my son back and this really never happened? Or does it mean that my son's life and death actually means nothing in this state? And how do you expunge death? My son died on the pavement. How do you expunge that? Do I believe that people change? Yes, I do. But can you erase history? No. My offender is part of my personal history now. This offender has become part of my life and that of every member of my family. I can't erase or expunge that or the fact that my son is dead and my life has taken the route it has because of my criminal's deadly decisions and deeds. You'll probably notice that I refer to this man as my offender or my criminal. He is my own personal offender in so many aspects. He not only took the life of my son, he stole the life from our family. Nothing has or ever will be the same since or how it should have been. It's impossible to express the effect my offender has had on our family, that which he has destroyed. But I'd always pictured myself with grandchildren and great family gatherings. But none of that has happened. The empty chair cannot be escaped, erased, or expunged. Even after all this time, we still grieve. And the pain and mental pictures sometimes return unexpectedly and with a vengeance. It has totally changed the course of my life. It has driven me here to the legislature to lobby for tougher DUI bills for the past five sessions. So if you are tired of seeing me, I'm sorry. It wasn't my choice either. Criminally negligent homicide is the only homicide that can be expunged or set aside. The victim was also killed by another person, and I have no doubt that it was just as violent. And the victim is certainly just as dead as in any other criminal homicide. Does it make any sense that in the same criminal homicide, DUI cannot be expunged, but criminally negligent homicide can be? Many crim negs are the result of plea downs from manslaughters. Crim neg seems to be the catch-all for when there are errors or problems that exist or persist in a case. Evidentiary problems very often play a part in the conviction of criminally negligent homicides. In addition, in 2007, we passed aggravated vehicular homicide, House Bill 2740, which raises the penalty for a person who commits criminal homicides, which would be criminally negligent homicide, man one or man two, while they are driving under the influence of intoxicants. We cannot expunge or set aside a crime that has to be tracked or counted. Like driving under the influence, we need to know if they have previously committed the offense of criminally negligent homicide. Also, as a society, I believe we have the right to know who these offenders are who kill. Do we want them driving a school bus, an ambulance, a long-haul truck, a beer delivery truck, or do we want them to work as a security guard, a police officer, or a nanny? I also believe we have the right to know who we rent to, sell guns to, or hire. In spite of what we have lost, I have never felt beaten by this offender. But if his crime were to be expunged, I would not only feel beaten by this offender, but also by the state of Oregon. Do not continue to re-victimize the families who have also lost because these violent offenders have been convicted of criminally negligent homicide. I also brought today testimony from Marie Armstrong, who could not be here today. Her son was killed in 1996. The offender was convicted of criminally negligent homicide, and he served 90 days. In addition, the ODAA also fully supports this bill. Please do not continue the expungement of criminally negligent homicide convictions to continue. Please remove it from the list of expungible offenses. I urge you to please pass House Bill 2796. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Janet Lovelace. I live in the Pleasant Hill, Eugene area. I also am a member of MAD and of Crime Victims United. I'm here today to express my concern that the crime of criminally negligent homicide is on the list of crimes that can be expunged from an offender's record. That a person having been convicted of the crime of criminal negligent homicide would be given the opportunity to remove from their criminal history the information that the public has a right to have access to. That this individual, having been responsible for the death of another person, able to delete this record, is outrageous beyond words. Crimneg, as it is called, is a felony, a crime that results in the death of another person. A human being is now gone from this earth at the direct negligent actions of another. The possibility of the expungement of the crime of crimneg should never be under discussion. To allow expungement would be grossly unjust to those people killed under this crime and to their grieving families. The possibility of wiping the slate clean after taking the life of another person under any circumstances, under any given period of time, is wrong and is negligent on the part of the justice system. My 12-year-old daughter was killed in June of 2000. Although he tried to cover up his crime through an elaborate scheme, Lee Russell Stubbs was eventually apprehended and convicted of criminally negligent homicide. He served only 18 months for this charge. My family, our friends, concerned citizens of the small Pleasant Hill community were left speechless and in shock over Stubbs' minimal sentence. My Katie lost a potential 70-plus years of her life. The offender was inconvenienced for 2.5 years of his life. That his record could be cleared one day of this criminal behavior would be yet one more injustice added to what my family and I have had to already endure and continue to endure. When I informed my family, friends, and coworkers that I was going to Salem to testify on this bill, all had the same response to me. They were in disbelief that crimneg could ever be removed from a criminal's record. The overwhelming consensus was, and I quote, "That is insane that the offender's record could be cleared. They killed a person. That's crazy." Katie's death forever changed me and my family. We have adjusted to our lives without our Katie, but we are never without the pain of not having her with us. Please honor my daughter's memory and all of those who have been killed due to a criminal's negligence. Do not allow this crime to be on the list that can be expunged. Remove criminally negligent homicide from the expungement list by supporting House Bill 2796. Thank you.
Chair Barker. Members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. I'm the longtime retired district attorney for Lane County, and I know about these cases. I want to take a little different tact on this statute. The criminal justice system is a search for the truth, as well as the civil justice system. And we swear witnesses in. We require them to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth under penalty of perjury, or in the old days, swearing to God. So we search for the truth. We find the truth in these cases, and a jury or a judge, or by a guilty plea, enters a conviction for criminally negligent homicide. The search for truth is important. And then we have a statute on the Oregon books that hides the truth. Interesting concept. I remember reading over 30 years ago an editorial from the Eugene Register Guard where they were lamenting the fact that the truth was not out there for everybody on all cases that were sealed. And actually, we don't expunge them as such. What we really do is the conviction or the arrest is sealed under the statute. And then we try to take it out of all of those criminal justice records to comply with the order of the court. So we have a statute that is a hodgepodge of what you do seal and what you don't seal. And basically the way it works is the less serious offenses can be sealed and the more serious offenses, the A and B felonies, cannot be sealed. That's an oversimplification, but that's the way the statute basically works. And we have an exception for traffic offenses, so if you or I or anybody else gets a traffic offense, it's there forever. That speeding ticket is there forever. However, the criminally negligent homicide doesn't have to be there forever under the statute. So it seems like it's a very serious offense, as these two here have told us. And what we ought to do is we ought to say this one is serious enough that it should not be sealed. We should not hide the truth in this particular type of situation. And just a note, we've talked about vehicle cases, crash cases. There's also other kinds of negligent homicide, but somebody did die in these. It could be a careless, not a careless, but a criminally negligent use of a firearm. And just to refresh some memories, criminal negligence is a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur. The risk must be of such nature and degree that the failure to be aware of it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. I'd suggest to you that that conjures up very serious behavior on the part of the individual. And finally, you could help the district attorneys out who try to be very creative in this, and I checked in with the office that I was in for so long, there's some very creative lawyers there, and so their arguments now to stop these expungements go like this. The defendant's conviction for negligent homicide is not eligible. Why is it not eligible? Because it's a state traffic offense. And the definition of traffic offense. So they make that argument, and then they say in the vehicle code there's a suspension for 8 years, which there is right now for this, and because of that, traffic offenses are not expungible. So they weave this complex little thing to get to the stage, and judges are buying it because they don't want to expunge this either in Lane County. We just ought to say criminally negligent homicide should not be expungible. And it's pretty easy to do in the statute. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you again for your testimony. I know, I believe you're bringing up the whole thing over again. And it's helpful to us to see real people with these real stories. Committee, Mrs. Pratt brought up something on page 3, line 11 of the bill. It says a conviction or arrest for criminally negligent homicide. It was not her intent to have arrest in there because somebody could be arrested and found not guilty. That would be able to they'd be able to carry that record. So we're going to look for an amendment to take care of that in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2796. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2827.
Mr. Chair, while we're waiting, could I please take this opportunity to recognize the AmeriCorps volunteers who are with us today. A lot of them are here to meet with their legislators. So thank you for coming, and we wish you all the best in your community work.
Thank you very much. Hope you get to see who you're looking for today.
House Bill 2827 extends the statute of limitations for an action based on child abuse, provides that an action must commence before the victim reaches age 40 or within 5 years from the date the victim discovers the causal connection between the injury and the abuse, whichever is longer. We have a minimal fiscal expenditure and no revenue impact. The bill is ready to be worked if the committee chooses.
Thank you. Mr. Marks, please. I'm looking what? Here.
Oops.
I look here.
I prefer
see
Mr. Martin.
What's my name?
Go ahead.
What?
Identify yourself since you're unknown to us.
Mr. Chair, I don't know why you're sitting on the right of me and I'm sitting on the left of him. I'm confused.
From our view, you're in the right place.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of House District 15 in the Albany area. And I'm just going to read through quickly here a letter that I've provided to the chair and you all. House Bill 2827 changes the civil statute of limitations for actions based on a contract that constitutes child abuse or conduct knowingly allowing, permitting, or encouraging child abuse. Additionally, this bill requires that an action must be commenced before a claimant attains 40 years of age or not more than 5 years from the date the claimant discovered or in exercise of reasonable care should have discovered casual or causal connection between child abuse and injury, whichever period is longer. About a year ago, I began paying attention to the need to extend the statute of limitations involving child abuse, and keep in mind I'm referring to the civil side of this issue. I was contacted by a mother whose daughter had been sexually abused as a child. The daughter is now an adult and is having severe emotional problems from past abuse, but is unable to seek action in this case due to the current law. I have come to learn that many victims become aware of their injuries later in life. Unfortunately, many of these victims have no avenue to pursue the perpetrator due to the amount of time that has passed. Initially, I was skeptical about this issue because I felt that a person should clearly know before they turn age 40 if their past abuse had caused an injury. And by injury, I mean psychological or emotional besides just physical. And currently, the law is not more than 6 years after the victim attains age 18 or within 3 years of the date the victim discovers or should have discovered the injury or the connection between the abuse and the injury. This past summer, I had the opportunity to talk with two victims who are now adults that were sexually abused as children. Both of these individuals were intelligent, career-oriented people with families. By all appearances, they had it all together. They explained to me how they did not connect the dots between the past abuse and their current emotional injuries until many years afterwards. They both remembered they were victims of abuse, feeling they had moved on and the past was now causing and was not causing any problems now. But that was not the case for either one of these two individuals. For example, a father in his early 50s explained how he had became aware of his injuries when his son reached the age the dad was when he was abused. And at that time, the father withdrew from his son, his wife, and his marriage, or his family and his marriage. He basically checked out. He later realized his current behavior was connected to the past abuse, connecting the dots. And with that, what I'd like is if Representative to the right of me here, Representative Garrett, would kind of share a little bit with you going through the statute or the bill that we're proposing. Two specific definitions, if you take a look at the first page there, for what injury is and the causal connection.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Chris Garrett, State Representative from District 38, and I'm happy to be here as the co-chief sponsor of House Bill 2827 with Representative Olson. He's done most of the work on this legislation, and I'm here as his sidekick, really, but I am strongly in support of this bill because I think it's an important legislative acknowledgement that the current statute of limitations is inadequate to protect the rights of individuals who suffer abuse as children. Current law cuts off their ability to bring suit at the age of 24 or within 3 years of discovering the injury. That's a problem in two ways. First, because of the unique effects of abuse on children, it may be many years after the age of 24 that they begin to connect the dots, as Representative Olson said, between what happened to them when they were young and the injuries that are manifested later in life. Second, the statute refers to injury, and that is problematic in that it's a question of how will the word injury be construed. And by making it clear that the discovery of the causal connection is the triggering fact, it will expand the ability of individual claimants to bring claims later in life once they do connect those dots, as Representative Olson said. So that is really what the bill does, and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, anybody? Representative Shields.
Mr. Chair, so just to clarify, we're talking about civil actions, not criminal actions.
Okay. Mr. Chair, yeah, Representative Shields, that's right.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've told the representatives this privately, but I'd like to say it publicly. I'd like to just commend them on crafting what I think is a magnificent piece of legislation. It is things like this that I think will truly help people who have endured unimaginable things. And is this legislation like this makes me proud to be a public servant.
Thank you. Any comments? Thank you very much.
Kudos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, guys.
Mr. Martin, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I represent the Oregon Catholic Conference. It is difficult enough to talk about a bill that's popular, let alone one that's sponsored by all but two of these committee members. So I would like to first start off by saying we have concern about the language that has just been spoken of. I want to start by saying I'm not an attorney, so I'm not going to debate any of the attorneys in here. I know some history about this whole statute. This is a statute that resulted in the bankruptcy of the Oregon Catholic Church about a few years ago, and out of that situation have come numerous lawsuits. The new language that is suggested on lines 15 through 24 appear to us to be directly out of a lawsuit brought recently against the church. I'm meeting tomorrow with the attorney that was involved to confirm that, and I'm concerned about going back 20-some years ago, the Senate Judiciary Committee in the Senate started this whole ball rolling by taking off the then-existing statute of limitations, which was very limited. And Senator Joyce Cohen, who was the chair at the time, I've discussed this several times with her, was not in response to child abuse as much as it was a response to other issues that had to do with abuse and assault, and the language was changed. It has resulted in a number of these lawsuits. It's important to state for all of us that child abuse, especially sexual abuse, is abhorrent to everyone. And I'm the first one to say, and the Catholic Church is the first one to say, that we know we have been the cause of much of this, and you need to understand that there have been all kinds of actions taken within the Catholic Church, and I'm sure that's the case with other churches. The clergy that were involved, almost all of whom are dead, have either been imprisoned or discharged totally from the church. There have been corrective actions taken throughout the Catholic diocese in Portland and elsewhere, Eastern Oregon also, that include extensive training for anyone that's involved in any manner with children. Teachers, coaches, parents that are supervising all have to pass a abuse training program administered by a private company out of Texas that's probably as good as there is in the nation. There's training going on constantly. I'm positive I can say that anyone that was abusive is gone out of our system altogether. We're dealing with lawsuits now that go back a number of years. The casual reading of this would lead you to believe that after age 21 you've got only 5 years or so, or 3 years currently. That's not the case, because many of the lawsuits that have been brought by people in their 40s and 50s. The difficulty from a legal standpoint, is usually it is a dead guilty clergy member and a dead bishop who was in charge at the time, and there's virtually no defense when you go into court. Most of these have been settled out of court, minimum of about $250,000 in each case. The Catholic Church, when it went through bankruptcy, set aside $20 million at the court's direction for future cases. And I think we're concerned that this new language would very quickly result in almost that many cases being brought. We would like the opportunity to come back after I've had a chance to sit down with the attorney involved and give you some additional testimony. Perhaps there's a way we can find a compromise that you might be willing to listen to. But we are very concerned that the passage in its current form is going to lead to a tremendous number of lawsuits. We're concerned about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Let me just say for the record, as one of the two who happens, I think, not to be a co-sponsor of the bill, and I'm not sure how I missed it.
You're late, he says.
For the record, let me say, in response and with respect, in my view, the efforts of the church to clean your house, I view less as an alternative to robust tort law, and frankly view as more as something that is encouraged and has been encouraged by robust tort law.
Representative Stigler.
Are you done? Representative Smith. I would like to say for the record here, I would discourage this committee from delaying any action on this bill any further. This is an issue that has been out in the civil law domain for many, many years. It has been through this body on more than one occasion. What has occurred in the past was a compromise position. I think that the, for lack of a better term, the science involved in what I see as the language that's captured in subsection 2 of section 1 here is the result of a lot of history and a lot of victims that have gone through the process and through the system. And I would hope that we would not, we can talk words until the cows come home, and we're not going to get to a place where everybody's going to be in agreement. And frankly, I think under the circumstances, Representative Garrett and Olson have done a yeoman's job at putting together language that I think is about as succinct and discreet as we're going to get in this circumstance. So I would urge us not to delay it further.
Mr. Chair.
Could I respond?
Yes, you sure, certainly.
I understand the feelings. I want to point out to you that yesterday you passed legislation through the House that requires the exposing of all teacher records in all schools, both public and private. This statute covers private schools. It does not cover public schools. Public schools are exempt from this kind of thing. So if a girl is abused at St. Mary's High School, they can be prosecuted. If she was abused at Oregon City High School, she can, the same statute doesn't cover it. And if you are concerned about going after abuse at all levels, I think you ought to also talk about the public sector. This wouldn't cover the DHS situation that's horribly happened out of Mexico, because those public agencies are covered by a different exemption.
Okay. Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, I appreciate your bringing that to my attention, and I'm happy to work with Representatives Olson and Garrett in rectifying that public thing as well in a subsequent bill.
Further discussion? Yeah. Representative Smith.
Just to be clear for the record, you said there would be no prosecution. We're not talking about prosecution here. There would still be prosecution. What we're talking about is civil liability.
Civil liability.
And with regard to that, I'm with Brent.
You, Mr. Martin, thank you very much for your testimony. It's well taken. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
We ready?
Yeah. Close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2827 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Stigler moves House Bill 2827 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Representative Shields.
Mr. Chair, Council said that there has been a fiscal and there it's minimal or there is
it's
no?
It's minimal. We don't have a statement.
Okay.
Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Olson, would you and
I will. Thanks.
Representative Garrett co-carry that. Thank you. Motion carries that public or work session is closed. Open a work session on House Bill 2623.
All right. We're revisiting House Bill 2623 that we heard about, I believe, on Tuesday of this week. This authorizes the Department of Corrections to reduce the term of incarceration up to 60 days for inmates who successfully complete an educational program. You have in your packet a newly issued fiscal statement. What the fiscal department did was go back to the Department of Corrections, flesh out with a little more depth what this bill did. You'll note that now DOC has come down in some of their savings calculations and essentially believe that for the next biennium, they'll save somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million between 2009 and 2011 with this added 60-day credit.
Okay, any questions?
They did not give me parentheses.
Very nice. No questions?
We already adopted the definition.
We did.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think it's good that we got a fiscal statement. And I think the realities of this bill is to encourage people to obviously who are trying to get their lives back together to do the right thing. And that's what this is all about. And it just so happens in this case there may be a fiscal savings immediately to the state, but I think in the long run is what we're after with this series of reentry bills is to have these people come out and be productive members of our society. And that's really what this bill is all about, the series of other bills. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you, Representative Cameron. I know you've worked hard to see to it that people are coming out of prison with some hope and some training. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we have gotten a clearer picture and got the bill in sync then with the fiscal. You feel confident about that, Council?
Do I? Yes, yeah. I do.
Okay. And I think it. My understanding then is that basically what they're saying is that a certain number of people would not or will get this that might not have done other things that earned time credits would have been allowed for, so that's why we'll have the savings. And I just wanted to just commend Representative Cameron for working on this, because I think that there is an association between earned time and recidivism, and people who go to the trouble of completing what's required through earned time are much less likely to recidivate. It's not necessarily a cause and effect relationship, but it's more predictive, and I just appreciate the work on this.
Thank you. It encourages people to take those programs that will help them in the future.
Mr. Chair Barker, I was going to just reiterate that. I think that particularly when the earned time is not just for sort of sitting and doing, just being a good person or not getting into trouble, but when it's something really proactive and something that actually underscores the fact that they're trying to take the next step. I applaud Representative Cameron for the effort.
Call the roll, please.
We have a motion.
Aye. We have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2623?
I gave away my
as amended.
Yes.
As amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2623 to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Now you can call the roll. roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Cameron, would you carry that, please?
Sure.
And actually, we didn't need the motion because we never withdrew your motion from before, but that's okay. It got moved.
Now we've got two motions.
It's a good motion.
I think Ramona's calling.
No further business before the committee. We adjourn.
Ramona's calling.